Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your Nash Becca of music news and lyrical analysis. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. At least that's what people say. That's what people say. But I keep... With us is John Caramonica, who has written about the new Taylor Swift record, 1989.
No, it's Becky. Yeah, it's John. Yeah, Tay-Tay.
Your piece talks a lot about how Taylor Swift has undergone a significant change in this record. And first, I want you to talk about what that change is.
It's important to understand when you're talking about Taylor making a pop record. Taylor's been making versions of pop records for a long time now, but they've been coming from a very specific place. Taylor is someone who, as a teenager, was making country songs, but they were always deemed a little too pop for mainstream country, for the center of country, a little too female, a little too young. That didn't stop them from becoming huge hits and turning her into basically the biggest star on the planet, or at least in America. So there was an inevitability that she would eventually just like leave the country box behind at some point. And you started to see this on Red, which was her last album. There were two or three songs that felt very specifically pop songs. You have I Knew You Were Trouble. Yes. You have 22. To a lesser degree, We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I Knew You Were Trouble. When I heard that, I was like, ooh, this is interesting. Because not only is it a straight pop song, but it's like half a dubstep pop song. Right. And it's not a dubstep song in the sense that some dubstep producer got her to sing on their song. It's she basically had Max Martin produce like a fake dubstep light song. And that became a huge hit single for her.
Right.
And you're like, okay. And that at that time, that was, I mean, you don't want to say cutting edge because obviously it's just a mainstream appropriation of an underground sound. But for what was happening on a Z100 type pop station, it was pretty forward looking. Right. So I was like, I wonder if this is what Pop Taylor is going to sound like. But it actually turns out that Pop Taylor, as you hear on 1989, doesn't sound anything like that.
Right.
Pop Taylor is an entirely different thing. She made a record that many, many parts of which would have been very at home, I think, in 1985 or 1986, 1984, like that time period. She's harking back to a period of pop before hip-hop suffused it, before R&B suffused it. It's sort of, it's shimmery. It has, it's pretty white. Let's just put it out there. It's just pretty white. It seems to me a conscious decision to make pop that is not going to sort of get bogged down in the same kind of debates that a Miley or a Justin Bieber or whatever. It seems designed consciously or subconsciously to steer around that kind of stuff.
So you're saying that up till now she was in a country box basically, but she was saying, I'm country but not country, and that was her way of fighting against something. But now you're saying she's hiding in the bushes of 80s pop to some degree, and that becomes her new embattled context. This is what makes her different.
Well, this is what I talk about in the beginning of the piece, whereas, look, if you're Taylor Swift, age 16, 17, young female singer-songwriter making songs about your experience, what better Goliath is there than Nashville, big old mean Nashville, mm-hmm. dudes with hats saying mean things about women and how they don't write their own songs and how they'll never let them on the radio and stuff. What a great enemy for her to have and for her to vanquish and render completely irrelevant.
Sure.
I mean, she did all of that in like 3 or 4 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she basically got in, got huge, and then leapfrogged the damn thing.
Right.
Once she's stepping out into pop, there is no obvious enemy.
Right.
I like this record a lot, but there is a thing that it's lacking, which is it's lacking a tiny bit of context.
Right.
And I think part of that is because there is no obvious enemy. So I think what's happened is by choosing to go in this direction, this more 80s pop direction, and avoiding anything that sounds even remotely current in terms of like current production techniques and styles, she's created the enemy.
So the enemy is the go-to pop producers of the moment, which is basically we're talking about black pop producers.
Right, or white producers doing black music.
Producers of black pop. Okay.
That seems like a very deliberate choice.
I want to push against that just
Please.
A little bit. The title of the record is 1989, and she has a history of doing very clever things with ideas of age and time. You know, she had a song 15 and a song 22.
Are you going to do some ill numerology on me?
And, the title 1989 It's another like specific time thing. Oh, what does that make you think of? 1989. Well, that's the year she was born. So
is this where I just stop you right there?
It's sort of like music begins with Taylor Swift, you know, and, like, yeah, yeah. And her story from now on is the story of music,
sure.
Or something like that. Oh, that's kind of clever. And also it has, I guess it has the double meaning of, you know, what you may hear on this record may make you think of music from the late 80s or the mid 80s.
Yeah.
And there are specific examples of that on the record. But is that what the whole record is all about? We just heard the song Shake It Off. Tell me about Shake It
Off.
Sure.
No, I don't think that's what Shake It Off is about. I'm not sure. I think there's maybe two answers to that
there's
question.
A blueprint for everything.
Sure.
What's a blueprint for Shake It Off?
Okay. I'll answer that in a sec, but there's two answers to that question.
Yes.
I'm not sure that that's what this record is about,
yeah.
But that's what this record evokes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are two separate things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think by and large, this record evokes that time period and that idea of pop music,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a more elegant term, a pre-miscegenated idea of pop music, which the copy desk would not let me use.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to use it here.
Mm-hmm.
There's that. Now, does that mean that every piece works in that direction? No. But I do think you look at Shake It Off – and you just say, well, that's Tony Basil. That's
mm-hmm.
Mickey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's 1983 or 1984 or whatever
mm-hmm.
that was.
Mm-hmm.
But Shake It Off, there are a couple songs on this record that are very much like playing with the idea of what Taylor Swift is.
Mm.
You know, Taylor's a very good songwriter. She's very clever. And she is now at the point where writing meta Taylor Swift songs are sort of just part of the thing.
Mm.
And Shake It Off is a bit of a meta Taylor Swift song. And she's like, got nothing on my brain.
Isn't Shake It Off as much Pharrell as Tony Basil?
For being recent Pharrell?
No. I'm questioning the thing about, you know, I'm questioning the 80s narrative. I'm saying, I'm wondering whether it's a clever red herring.
Here's the thing. Everything in Shake It Off is basically on the one. There's nothing on the two, on the four. There's nothing on the backbeat. There's no blue notes.
Right.
Her voice has no color in it. No pun intended, but like that's not everything in the Pharrell records. I think you're thinking of having like this,
mm-hmm.
and this is
mm-hmm.
it's two different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm listening to her, can you contend in some way that there's a line to be drawn from Happy to this? Perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Before all we know, Shake It Off was recorded before Happy was released.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she works on records for a year at a time.
Yeah.
I mean for a year in a row. So to me, maybe it distills down to a certain kind of simplicity,
mm-hmm.
but I do think the fundamentals of the record are different.
Now, do you think there's anyone out there among Taylor's younger fan base who's saying, oh,
shouts
no.
Shouts to everybody who follows me on Twitter.
Who's saying.
Shouts to all of y'all.
Who's saying, oh, no, she shouldn't have abandoned country. I liked her that way. Is anybody saying that?
No.
So, I mean, what's the big deal?
It is a big deal. Here's the big deal.
Yeah.
Part of what's made Taylor interesting is this idea that she's been pushing back against this very hidebound organization,
mm-hmm.
if you want to call country music or Nashville or Music Row an organization. You know, it's like Black Ops. They're just out there just being like, you will like Luke Bryan now. And all of a sudden, everybody likes Luke Bryan. Like, you will not like Chris Young, and Chris mm-hmm. Young will falter for years and years. Her working against that and triumphing over it is a great narrative.
Mm-hmm.
It elevates her beyond being just a writer and singer of great songs, but it elevates her as someone with a purpose.
Right.
Someone who is interested in change. Someone who's interested in pushing back against institutions that have a fixed idea and forcing their doors open and forcing them to accept new things.
Mm-hmm.
All well and good. Now she has no one to fight. And that's why I think there's the implicit enemy on this record. And of course, this is a deep read. I don't know that she and Max Martin and Shellback were sitting in the studio being like, no, mm-hmm. Later for you, Justin Bieber.
Mm-hmm.
Later for you, Miley. But I can imagine there being a conversation that was maybe not that, but was sort of like, we can't make a Miley record.
Well, exactly. The number one rule is we have to be distinct however we can.
And I think this is the choice. Now, the reason why it's important is I don't think all the little girls I used to see at Taylor shows in, sundresses and cowboy boots. I'm sure they grow up and they like country music, but I don't think those people need Taylor to be in country. I don't think it's that. But I do think if you're approaching this music the same way that you've approached her previous four or her prior four albums, what's not here on this record is what's the meaning? What's the broader context? What are you fighting against?
Speaking of Miley Cyrus, let's talk about the Shake It Off video
sure.
for a minute.
Absolutely.
Which has to be considered almost distinctly from the song.
It does, but I do think the Shake It Off video speaks to my point, which is here's Taylor, and it's not just hip-hop dancers in the videos and tutters and all that stuff. It's not all that. I mean, there's ballet dancers and, you know, modern dancers and all this stuff. But the entire thing is Taylor presenting herself as more naive, less engaged, less expert than all these other
than
people.
Than anyone, yeah.
Right.
She when can only be herself, and she can't front.
And that's the triumph at the end of the video,
right.
where like all the regular kids and dressed however, just like waving their arms and dancing around, and Taylor's like, yeah, this is me.
It's the triumph of not fronting. I can be queen.
But it's above.
Without, yes.
That's the thing.
I don't even have to try.
But it sells itself as below because all these other people, look at these experts
right.
flying through the air and doing these magical moves.
Right.
They're prima facie. They're the experts.
Right.
But at the end, it's Taylor's non-expertise and sort of casual joy that is actually triumphant.
And you feel that this pose is starting to look inauthentic.
I don't know that it's looking inauthentic, but I think it's notable that she is choosing to very blatantly place herself in opposition to all this stuff.
Right.
By making records that sound like the records on 1989 and by how that video looks, which is basically like, I am cool enough to know that this stuff is cool. I have enough money to make a video and hire all these dancers to do this expert stuff, but because it's my video and my song and my triumph, I win at the end.
Right. Okay, let's hear another track from the record, a song called Style. You got that dream.
That mean record, mean in the best sense, mean in the Funkmaster Flex sense. It's a mean record.
That's a song that sounds great.
That's a high. That's
to
the
me,
highest
that's,
praise.
That's the greatest sounding song on the record.
I totally.
It's also the
pretty sure I agree.
Maybe the most studiedly retro.
Yeah,
song.
It's the Miami Vice soundtrack.
There's another song. There's another song that gave me a little Wilson Phillips.
Ooh.
Vibe, but that was only
on
like
great look.
But that was on a vocal chorus.
Can we just sidebar and say yeah. memo to Taylor, make a Wilson Phillips record.
Yeah,
great.
Well, that's
just file that away for like when you're in 28.
I believe that's
30.
1990, so that's
yeah,
pretty close.
We're getting there.
Yeah,
all right, file that away.
So Style, retro, beautiful sounding song.
Oh, it's so luscious.
It's white LA pop at its greatest in 1987.
Right.
Or
it's
like
but
that.
It's like sleazy, but she just like takes all the sleaze out of it and keeps the kind of like low burn of it.
Yeah.
It's great. It's mm-hmm. really good. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a thing that I like about the song. I think production's great. It's Max Martin and Shellback and a guy named Ali Payami. Who I don't think pops up anywhere else on the record, which is primarily a Max Martin and Shellback production. I like that she also matches the tone of the song with the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
There's a, you know, she's playing games with the person she's talking to or singing to in this record. She's playing games with them. You know, he's playing her, she's playing him. A lot of times in the past when Taylor writes about relationships, it can be a little like, nah, nah, nah. You know, it's like a little like, you did this to me.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, she's a grown up and doing grown up things. And part of the grown-up's like, oh, you're gonna play me? I'm going to play you.
Mm-hmm.
I like that attitude. I also like how she's singing. Taylor's had some problems over the years with pitch problems and, you know, live performances that didn't go great and certainly has been critiqued enough for that. But I think it seems like she's done a really good job of working on her voice. And you hear that especially on the voice memos that are the bonus tracks on this record, which are basically unprocessed from what I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
She's done a really good job on her voice in terms of, you know, being on pitch and having power. But a thing that she does on this record also that I like is I feel she's using it in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's playing – she's up an octave. She's down an octave, which is not something she's always done. She's sort of like unspooling lines in this very casual, cool way, which is not something she's done before.
Mm-hmm.
You can hear the breathing through the singing in a way that you haven't always heard it. So rather than sort of being so straightforwardly singer-songwriter, just getting through the lyrics and like thinking the lyric is the most important thing, what she's doing here is, I think, slightly de-emphasizing the lyric and more emphasizing or giving more weight to the delivery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She doesn't, you know, she's not Adele.
She could stand to do a little more of that.
This is the thing. Like, she doesn't have the most powerful voice, mm-hmm. so that she has limits to what she can do. But I think it adds so much range, emotional range, to what's on this record and to how she delivers the record. I feel like I was taking note.
Yeah.
Every time she did something, it just jumped out at me.
Now, one thing we haven't mentioned yet is that she walks among us.
Oh, yeah.
She's been living in New York since the spring.
Absolutely.
She spent $20 million on Tribeca real estate.
It's just slightly more than I paid for my apartment.
Yeah. Obviously, this gives her a new it gives her some new identity issues to work with.
Sure.
You know, she can be a new X fish in a Y pond.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what the X and Y are.
Right, you know? Right. But I know,
like, there's some new thing about, you know, how she has this repeated thing of, like, you know, people are always looking at her and they're second guessing her or they're thinking she's not cool or whatever. She can sort of have fun with that in a whole new way in a New York context.
Right. Although the funny thing is, like, you know, she's like hanging out with Carly Kloss. You know, it's like, she can make that case, but at the same time, it's like she moved to New York as a super famous person, moving into a super rich neighborhood, buying a super expensive apartment, hanging out with super famous people.
Right.
Now, is that a valid New York experience? Sure. Like, it's one that plenty of people aspire to. You know, it's a lot like mine. but, you know, is that a valid New York experience? Of course it is. But it's maybe not. It's not the exact New York experience that she's singing about, especially on that first song on the record.
Well, the first song is the anthem of her being in New York, Welcome to New York.
Maybe not my favorite song on the record.
Maybe my least favorite song on the record. In fact, I, in my opinion, I think it's actually a failure.
Total fail.
Well, I mean, this is her song of being a naive.
Yes.
Like a real naive. Like, wow, I'm in a new place. I'm blinded by the possibility. And somehow, I think that she gives us some of her weakest lyrics, you know?
I think she's aiming, and this is something that I think is true on much of this record, but maybe very true on that song. I think she thinks that being a pop star or writing pop songs means aiming more broadly.
Yeah.
And stripping out some of the small diary stuff than
but
previous.
Does aiming more broadly mean that you assume a persona that knows less?
Well,
you know, because
I feel
like this is the persona that that knows very little. Whereas in her greatest work,
she knows
everything.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
And like, but I think they're two separate things. The divisions are two separate things. Because like what I hear in this song is partially what you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And partially, like, there's a song later in the record, it's escaping me what it's called, where she's talking about being like, I guess, a car accident with one of her boyfriends and they're in the hospital and he's getting 20 stitches. And you listen to that and you're like, oh, that's vintage Taylor.
Yeah.
Now, is that knowing Taylor? Maybe it's not knowing. Maybe it is. Maybe it's not. But it's vintage in terms of her presentation and her approach.
Yeah.
And then you go to Welcome to New York and it's everybody here wants something more, or everybody is different than everybody here is someone different than they were before. And you're like,
I think I've heard that somewhere.
Yeah, it's just deeply platitudinous. And it's not.
Also, kaleidoscope of loud heartbeats under coats.
Wow.
That's a mixed metaphor.
Hey.
You know what I'm saying?
Hey.
Taylor, you're better than that.
Yeah, true.
You've had freshman English just like all of us.
Actually, I don't think she has.
Freshman high school.
Well, freshman high school. Sure. It seems like the type of song you make when you're like, I need a song at the beginning of the record that sounds like, and I want it to set a stage.
Yeah.
And that's why in the piece, I'm like, oh, it's the John Hughes. It's like the opening song of the John Hughes movie.
Yeah.
You know? And there are several songs that have a John Hughes feel on the record. It feels like an intro.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, frankly, if it had been a minute 30
mm-hmm.
and it was an intro and it was like swell, chorus, linger, you know, chorus and then out, maybe that would have worked. But it didn't work as well as content
right.
to me.
Okay. Let's talk about This Love for a minute. That, is that, am I wrong in thinking maybe that's the only track on the record with acoustic guitar?
I think so.
I mean, the acoustic guitar is what often, what coded it as country in the past.
I don't have, I didn't get an instrument by instrument credits, but it's the only one that Nathan Chapman produced.
Yeah.
And Nathan Chapman's responsible for a lot of Taylor's early stuff.
Mm.
And if I understand correctly how that record came to be, it was not as part of the other sessions. It's sort of like Taylor was working on it and sort of called up Nathan, was like, I got something. Are you around? Can we do this?
Yeah.
So it was, the whole setup was different. That and Clean, which is the album closer, are the two that I think were the most anomalous in how they were made.
Yep.
This Love felt like it could have been on the last record, or two records ago, or three records ago. And you'll hear why.
All right, so This Love, it sort of reminds you a little bit of what she was doing
before,
Taylor
1.0,
where she came from, which actually is a very clever idea, isn't it? It gives you some continuity, just enough to remind you that this is the same person.
But it does have a little bit of that kind of like distance. It's not as direct as her earlier records. It has a little distance. It has a little bit of that Hunger Games distance, a little bit of that Civil War's distance, tiny, like a little foggy. There's a slight fog on
it
that record.
It has something going on in the beginning, like sort of trippy backwards effects in the background. Interesting for an acoustic guitar ballad by Taylor Swift.
So there's two reads on this, right? Well, there's multiple reads, but here are two possible reads.
Give me five.
Okay. I can do that. That's why I'm here. Okay. So here's the first one. This is cynical, and this is a way to signal to country and country radio programmers that if you want a Taylor Swift song to put in your rotation because you're tired of playing Brantley Gilbert songs all day long, here's something for you.
Wow.
I don't know if this is being worked to country radio. I asked, and I did not get a clean answer. It's possible that this is a bit of a wink.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as country as Taylor's previous songs, which were not that country to start with, in the same way that we imagine Garth Brooks to be super country, but at the time people were like, what the hell is this?
Mm-hmm.
At the time when Taylor's playing all the songs, they're like, that's not country.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, country radio programmers would be thrilled for something that sounded like that.
Wouldn't it be great, though? I'm getting way ahead of ourselves here, but wouldn't it be great if she gave country radio programmers a song that coded country in whatever way, acoustic guitar, ballad, you know, but was really weird.
Like,
and
super.
They, you know, and they'd have to do something with it, right?
Like No Flex
Taylor
Zone.
Taylor Swift.
Like a cover of No Flex Zone.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the other memo to Taylor, is acoustic cover of No Flex Zone.
I'm not telling Taylor Swift what to do.
No,
let's,
you can't.
Let's just
Why
get
would
that
you?
Straight.
Serious. I can barely tell myself what to do.
Mm.
All right. But This Love, like my cynical read on This Love is like, it's a wink. That said, I actually like this song quite a bit. It's not – it doesn't – it feels comfortable as someone that's grown up with Taylor and watched her.
Have you know?
Sure. You know, out there in Pennsylvania, Lackawanna, Mechanicsville, wherever it was. Mm. Why am I saying? Why am I saying? That town.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. All the time. It feels very – like you said, there's your continuity. Mm. It feels comfortable.
Mm.
To me, it feels cynical. The other thing that's less cynical is I do think that if you look especially at what Taylor did on, I think it was the Hunger Games soundtrack, maybe it was the Twilight soundtrack, I'm forgetting which soundtrack. She's really was a fan of the Civil Wars, and like I said, there's this sort of like spooky country that she's was starting to lean towards a little bit. That I don't know if it sat super well on her, but it seemed to be something she was really interested in.
Mm.
This maybe is the distilled version of that.
Right.
That so it's not going full.
A sincere attempt to get close to a pre-existing sound that she
enjoys.
She
digs. And because it's ultimately a pretty unaffected song, it's the least produced song on this record, short of Clean, which maybe even less than Clean, it's less produced. It really, it does feel like it comes from the straightest place Those are, I think, the two available options. Mm-hmm. I mean, other than the third option, which is just like, hey, man, it's just whatever happens, happens. It's just art.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just art.
Okay. By contrast to This Love, there's a track on the record called Bad Blood.
Which is probably as close to opposite sounding in terms of the...
It's got a huge beat and a really big echoey chorus.
And also,
I can never tell if the beat is like is more related to Grindin or Billy Squier.
See, I think it's to me it's Billy Squier. Uh-huh. But yes, I think it's basically
Pharrell again.
Sure. Okay. Is that going to be your counterpiece?
Just putting an idea out there.
That's cool. I encourage everybody to take up arms.
Now, you say that this record has nothing to do with mainstream pop or very little to do with mainstream pop.
Not with mainstream pop, with current production techniques and ideas and sounds of mainstream pop.
Well, I hear a similarity to some degree between this and, say, Katy Perry's Roar.
Sure. Okay, and whatever the song that Roar sounded like, which is escaping my mind at the moment. Do you remember what it was?
It's gone. It's wiped from my memory.
That's what Katy Perry will do. just flashed out. Okay.
What do you say to that, John Caramonica?
Cool.
Yeah.
Good one.
Uh-huh.
That's what I got.
Yeah.
This is the closest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not scared to look you in the eyes, critic to critic, and say, this is as close as you get to undermining my argument.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to undermine my argument, but this is as close as you get. This feels like, you know what this actually kind of feels like to me? Taylor is close friends with Ed Sheeran. And Ed Sheeran basically is like an arena folk singer who loops his own beats and like, you know, makes small songs sound big.
Sure.
When I heard this, after I got over the Billy Squier thing, I was like, this sounds like something Ed Sheeran would do like on a loop pedal at Madison Square Garden. Boom. And just like get the crowd, get the crowd clapping and beat. And then you could just say whatever you want on top of it. It felt spare enough and with enough room for her to do what she does that it seemed like this kind of like arena folk thing.
Right.
Also, part of the reason it's opposite from This Love is, you know, This Love is very sweet. I mean, it's an angry song, but in terms of her vocal approach, it's more familiar. It's a sweeter vocal approach.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like a bratty vocal approach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got bad blood. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Used to be mad. You know, this is Taylor. And again, it's like, I don't think Taylor should rap. Like, she raps a little bit on Shake It Off, but largely to show you that she's not a rapper. You know, but I don't think Taylor should be doing that. But I think Taylor should be employing different vocal approaches and trying different things with her voice. And I like the idea that she's just like being bratty on the record.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's interesting. You want to argue against me? How about this?
Mm.
That vocal approach.
You're going to supply an argument.
I am.
Well, then I'm not going to use it, but go ahead.
Yeah, that vocal approach, that's pretty Kesha, that vocal approach.
Uh-huh.
It's a pretty Kesha vocal approach.
Uh-huh.
I don't think Taylor, I mean, I'm sure Taylor listens to Kesha, like she listens to everything else. I'm not sure she was consciously channeling it, but that idea in the last 5 years of pop music has been most effectively deployed by Kesha.
Yeah.
Vocally, this sounds the most like Kesha to me.
Interesting. So it's another example of cover the bases, defang the what? What's the word? The people out there, the critics, the opponents, the
of which I am not one.
The forces.
But I think probably if there was one song that I could remove from the record to make my point arrogantly, it would probably be Bad Blood.
And maybe you would say, Taylor, you can just use this as a special live thing to do with a loop pedal.
B-side on a 7-inch, maybe. A thing that I think on the last record, on Red, which is like a very, very, very good record by all measurements, but the songs that are the big glossy pop songs sound different than the rest of the record. They kind of take you out of the record a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
This record largely succeeds in not having moments like that, except Bad Blood sort of is not quite in line.
Okay.
And like maybe Out of the Woods, I think, fits thematically in terms of the style of music, but the production is much more intense on that record, I think. And so
it is.
Yeah.
It's quite dense. It's quite echoey. It's Jack Antonoff doing that thing he does with echoed background voices,
which is just very different from all the Max Martin stuff.
Yes.
Which is more
focused and precise.
But I think Bad Blood, like you say, it could be. Is it Grindin? Is it Billy Squier? It's sort of timeless.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you can slip into it.
Because all music is either one or the other.
Sure.
It's either Listen to us.
I actually have
and we're trying to tell Taylor Swift what to do.
I actually have two iPods. One's called Grindin', one's called Vinny Squire. And just depending what mood I'm in the morning, that's what I go with.
Now, in the bonus version of the record, there's some sort of personal messages from Taylor to her fans.
Yes.
About how some of the songs were made.
Yeah. I mean, there's three, and they're meant to reflect three different ideas or three different approaches to how songs get made.
Mm.
So for I Wish You Would, which is, I think, the other Jack Antonoff song, it's a track that he sent her. And she's singing on top of the track and recording. I guess the track is playing like in a room over speakers.
Right.
Or maybe out of her computer. And she's just singing and the phone's recording.
So as if it's the first time she's ever heard it.
Right.
No, not really. But she's written some lyrics and she's just singing. And it sounds somewhat
spontaneous.
Yeah, it's maybe she hasn't heard this many times before.
There are a few things more appealing than the performance of spontaneity.
Mm.
Just in life.
Mm.
There's like we have. A few things more appealing than that.
I'm reading my script right now and doing it well.
Absolutely. I get paid by the word. Then there's I Know Places, which is basically a guide vocal that she sent to Ryan Tedder, who is a person who I don't like.
Mm-hmm. From One Republic.
Let's not even. So it's a guide vocal where she says, I have this idea, and she's sort of playing, I think, a piano version and giving half the lyrics with kind of like, filling in the rest with mumbles.
Right, some
which I love.
Stuff.
And I also there are some rappers that write that way, which I think is great, where you just go in the booth and mumble it out until you figure out the words that are supposed to fit, which I think is a phenomenal approach. So that's another thing. And then the third is, I think, her playing Max Martin and Shellback, an early version of Blank Space, and them being
spontaneously
adding little literal spontaneous eruptions. You can't think of how much each one of those vocal eruptions costs.
Yeah.
Do you think they charge by the vocal eruption?
And interestingly, for all the critics out there, in the heat of the moment on that little thing, she's hanging out with Max Martin and Shellback, and they're going, woo, you know?
Oh.
She said, oh, it reminds me of an early 2000s
Nelly track.
Oh, Taylor just gave us a clue.
True story. and to Taylor's credit, Taylor was dancing along the Florida Georgia Line at award shows way before it was cool. That's worth noting.
Hmm.
Certainly before I danced at any Florida Georgia Line show.
Did her doing it make it cool?
I don't know if that's true, but I think that in the case of, not to get too far off topic, but in the case of Florida Georgia Line, there was this initial repulsion. And then a certain bit of relenting.
Yeah.
And they're just accepting that a lot of their stuff's kind of beautiful.
Yeah.
In a very naive way. And she was at the repulsion stage. She was in on it.
Mm-hmm.
So she was ahead of all of us.
Mm.
So kudos on that.
Isn't that just an influential person doing what the hell she wants to do?
Yeah.
Okay. So now that we have that established.
Damn straight.
The aforementioned Blank Space.
Blank Space, major record, I think.
It's about how nobody can date her for more than a weekend.
No,
and it has
all in air quotes. The whole thing's in air quotes.
Yeah, it has fun with that idea.
It's great.
As if she is the most trouble on earth and she's just going to wreck people's lives. And it's funny.
You look like my next mistake.
Yeah.
What a great line. If I was single, I would use that line on somebody.
Yeah. Isn't there one part where she's mimicking people talking about her? Who is she? Who is she anyway?
Right. Look, it's gotta be miserable having every sort of micro part of your personal life being scavenged by folks in the tabloid space. It's gotta be awful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only natural to want to say something about it.
Yeah.
But I think this is a mature response, which is don't be tabloids are bad.
Mm-hmm.
Of course they're, but whatever. They're also bad and we all read them. So that's a lame dead-end argument.
Yeah.
So instead, take what they say about you and
do something artistic with
it. Do something clever with it.
So in a way, this is another line of continuity to her earlier work, to some of her earlier hits, and also to the chatter around her. right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of taking the critique and then making art from it.
Yes, but
Mean's a good example of that from two albums ago where she talks about the criticisms.
Yeah, right. So connecting it to the person she was and reminding you that this is a new record with a new sound, but I'm the same person.
Yeah,
which she has to do.
I mean, I don't think that she's trying to advertise
herself. Almost legal responsibility that she has to tell people she's the same.
Here's the thing. I don't think she's trying to advertise herself as a different person. But I think in terms of like the proportions, what percentage she's emphasizing one thing over another thing, that's what's shifting. But I don't think she's trying to be like, again, I wouldn't be surprised if like at some point in the recording process, her and Max Martin and Shellback are sitting in a room and being like, well, we cannot do what Miley has done. Because what Miley did was molt into an entirely different organism. Taylor cannot do that and wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be credible. I say in the piece that like what's not on this record is what is as important as what's on this record.
Yeah.
I firmly believe this. If Taylor wanted to do a 12-song concept album about heartbreak, all duets with Drake, it would sell 5 million copies.
Yeah.
And it would be great. I think they're both really good. I think they'd figure out a middle point and they'd get it right. She could do that. She could do any number. She could do a thing where she works with Diplo and has Pitbull rapping. She could do any number of things. She could have DJ Mustard show up and give her a beat. Mm-hmm. She's Taylor Swift. She can do whatever she wants. She chose not to do any of those things, all of which would effectively be playing by the rules of 2014 pop. Mm-hmm. She chose another path. Did she choose it proactively or reactively? I can't totally say for sure. Did she choose it because if she had gone that path, then people would be like, oh, Taylor, you're not allowed to do that. Mm. I don't know. Did she do it because she purely loves 80s pop? Maybe she did it for that reason. Mm. My sense is it's probably a stew of all of those things. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will go out with Blank Space and we will remind our listeners that all the opinions that we've voiced on this podcast have been carefully sifted through. So as to reflect nothing to do with common attitudes, currently on the charts.
What? As that is garbled nonsense.
And thank you all for listening. Oh my God, look at that face. You look like my next mistake. Love's a game, wanna play. Thank you so much for listening. You can read John Caramonica on the subject of Taylor Swift at nytimes.com/music. Our producers are Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Got nothing in my brain.
And you can hear a little bit of Taylor Swift on our Spotify playlist. See you next week.
Subscribe to the podcast. Your name.